Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, April 23rd. Stocks finished up this holiday shortened week with the Dow Jones now at its highest mark since June 2008. As opposed to the prior week when the first quarter's initial earnings reports were lackluster, this week saw virtually all of the big names exceed expectations. But earlier, on Monday, stocks swooned on word that ratings agency Standard & Poor's lowered its long-term U.S. outlook for the first time as it slapped a negative label on Uncle Sam. The action was warranted, and not a surprise, it's just that no one foretold the timing. Upon word from S&P on Monday morning, stocks fell to across 2% across the board before cutting their losses to about 1% by day's end, and the rest of the week was of a far more positive nature as earnings took over. Nonetheless, while some by week's end were poo-pooing the move by an agency that played a large role in the subprime mortgage crisis, it was indeed important. After all, S&P stated in its release that there was a 1 in 3 chance the United States would lose its coveted AAA rating within 2 years if lawmakers didn't get serious about cutting the deficits in a credible fashion. This is good. It certainly should focus Congress on the task at hand. Now, ask me if such a credible plan will actually be enacted, and by end of this year, because by January 2012, it will be too late. The political atmosphere poisoned by the looming elections. But this week's announcement by S&P gives me an excuse to review the two components of the $14.3 trillion in debt that you hear so much about. Around May 16, the exact $14.294 trillion debt ceiling will be hit, and the debate is going to be intense these next few weeks post-Easter recess. Time is running out, though technically there are moves Treasury can take to extend the final date to July 8, or so we're told. The public is opposed to raising the debt ceiling, but all manner of folks, including Wall Street and the Treasury Department, are warning that to fail to raise it would bring crisis in the financial markets. The thing is, many Republicans are saying they will not vote to increase the debt ceiling without an accompanying long-term deficit reduction plan, but there is no way there's enough time to hammer out a comprehensive package. At best, Republicans could hope to get more spending cuts, a la the just-brokered deal on the remaining 6 months of the fiscal 2011 federal budget, a sham deal, as we've since learned. Okay, so you have the debt ceiling issue to hike the current $14.3 trillion cap. Now, the $14.3 trillion is comprised of public debt and intergovernmental debt. $9.7 trillion is the public debt, the amount the U.S. government owes its creditors. This is about 63% of the gross domestic product, or a lower ratio than Germany's, let alone Japan's. However, it's this 63% that is racing towards 90% and higher, 90 being an important benchmark to some economists. As in history shows, when debt reaches this level, economic growth of any significant kind is very hard to come by, i.e. Japan's experience of the last 20 years. The other $4.6 trillion of the $14.3 trillion is intergovernmental debt, or primarily that owed to the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. It's money that's been promised, but as opposed to the public debt, Congress could always change the rules and terms in the case of these two entitlements. You can't change the terms on the public debt, though, or you're in default. Now, some say the warning by S&P and the threat to lower the nation's AAA rating is ludicrous because the Fed can simply print more money to cover the debt. Though this doesn't come without a price. Think Weimar Germany and inflation. Nonetheless, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, when asked by Fox Business reporter Peter Barnes, is there a risk that the United States could lose its AAA credit rating, yes or no? Geithner responded, no risk of that. Barnes, no risk. Geithner, no risk. Jonathan Weil, Bloomberg. It's enough to make you wonder, how could Geithner not know this to be true? The short answer is he couldn't. All you have to do is read the research report Standard & Poor's published on April 18, and you will see it estimated the risk of a downgrade quite succinctly. We believe there is at least a 1 in 3 likelihood that we could lower our long-term rating on the U.S. within 2 years, said S&P. There you have it. Geithner says the chance of a downgrade is zero. S&P says the odds it will cut its rating might be greater than 1 out of 3. So why are you going? Who are you going to believe? Geithner or the people at S&P who actually will be deciding what S&P will do about S&P's own rating of U.S. sovereign debt? It would be one thing to express the view that a downgrade would be unwarranted or that the chance of it happening is remote. Either of these positions would be defensible. Geithner went beyond that and staked out an absolutist stance that reeks of raw arrogance. There is no risk a rating cut will occur. He left no room for a trace of a possibility, ever. The mystery is why Geithner would say such a thing. What's he going to do if S&P or some other rating company winds up disagreeing with him? Send Barney Frank to beat them up? The problem for leaders who make indefensible claims like this one is that after a while, nobody knows whether to believe anything they say. Just remember all those government officials in Greece, Ireland, and Portugal who kept saying their countries didn't need bailouts long after it became clear they did. So that was Jonathan Weil of Bloomberg. On the issue of the budget debate now in Congress, Stanford economics professor John B. Taylor in an op-ed with the Wall Street Journal. Americans are clamoring for a fact-based debate about the budget, but the numbers they're hearing from Washington are terribly confusing. Here's an example. Speaking at a Facebook town hall meeting here on Wednesday, President Obama sometimes talked about saving $4 trillion, at other times $2 trillion, and he varied whether it was over 10 years or 12 years, never mentioning any 1 year. Taylor says one key is just to look at the history of government spending. In 2000, spending was 18.2% of GDP. In 2007, it was 19.6%, but in the 3 years since 2009, it's jumped to an average of 24.4%. Second, and perhaps even more striking, is that Mr. Obama, in his budget submitted in February, proposed to make that spending binge permanent. Spending would still be more than 24% of GDP at the end of the budget window in 2021. Third, the House budget plan proposed by Representative Paul Ryan simply removes that spending binge. It gradually returns spending as a share of GDP back to a level seen only 3 years ago. When I show people this chart, Taylor's referring to the history of government spending, they ask why Washington is even having the debate. They say if government agencies and programs functioned with 19 to 20% of GDP in 2007, why is it so hard for them to function with that percentage in 2021, when GDP will be substantially higher and with many opportunities for reforms and increased efficiencies? And if GDP and employment grow more quickly, as they would if private investment increased as a result of lower government spending and debt, then that 19 to 20% share of GDP could provide much more in the way of public goods. So that was John B. Taylor. Well, as you now know, the president took the rare step of revising his original budget in response to the Ryan plan. It moves closer to Ryan's goal, but still leaves a big part of the Obama binge in place. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. In the great budget debate, Democrats and Republicans are closer than you might think. Neither is proposing a balanced budget anytime soon. Both peddle soothing myths to convince supporters that they're upholding either liberal or conservative values. Meanwhile, the public seems largely clueless about the enormity of the problem. The Congressional Budget Office reckons that in 2021, even after a full economic recovery, the remaining deficit will equal about 5% of gross domestic product. In today's dollars, that's $750 billion. It's the hole that needs filling. Now, I just have to interject here, not to insult your intelligence. Just want to stop and be clear with the casual reader and listener of this stuff. Earlier, I discussed the $14.3 trillion national debt. Samuelson is discussing the federal budget deficit, which today is over 10% of GDP, hopefully heading to 5% and then below. To put this in perspective, when you hear about the euro crisis across the pond, the 17 nations holding the euro currency are supposed to have budget deficits of no more than 3%. At least that's the target. So back to Samuelson. Quote, Our budget problem is conceptually simple. Government spending commitments driven by more retirees and uncontrolled health costs vastly exceed the existing tax base. There is an argument about how fast changes should be made to protect the economic recovery. There should be no argument over the need for changes to prevent a debt crisis. Too many treasury bonds frighten investors and drive up interest rates. But it also matters how we do this, by policy and procrastination. Both Democrats and Republicans would largely exempt today's elderly from changes and shift the burden to workers and the young. That's not liberal or conservative. It's expedient and bad for America's future. It suggests the young will pay even higher taxes and receive even fewer public services. It will make raising a family harder and possibly deter millions from doing so. It may endanger America's security by short-sighted military cutbacks. We still await a serious debate about which programs to cut and which taxes to raise. Congressional Republicans advance a radical plan for shrinking government and are not candid about it. Obama defends the status quo of ever bigger government and is not candid about it. Perhaps these are negotiating positions, and needing to raise the federal debt ceiling, both sides will recognize their shortcomings. It's a hope. Well, so I look at all the preceding and think, okay, Congress should be able to at least come to agreement on the debt ceiling, but what of the longer-term credible plan necessary to avoid the U.S. losing its AAA rating next year? Or by 2013 at the latest. No way we are strong enough to get it done. Which was my point the other week when I said the market will crash in 2012 as reality hits global financial markets in the face, aided by a little computer-generated chicanery, of course. I mean, just look at the following poll data from this week. In a Washington Post ABC News poll, 78% oppose cutting spending on Medicare as a way to chip away the debt. On Medicaid, the government insurance program for the poor, 69% disapprove of cuts. Further, 56% are against cutting military spending, showing yours truly just how little the public understands how in so many ways we are being taken to the cleaners in defense spending. You know, I'm just musing, but every high school student should be required to read 5 speeches, Washington's farewell address, Lincoln's 2 inaugural addresses, Eisenhower's farewell address, and Kennedy's inaugural address. But back to the polls. Though in a New York Times CBS News survey, only 29% believe cutting the deficit as a way to improve the economy would create more jobs, which shows an appalling lack of fundamental understanding of global capital markets. If the world sees the United States is committed to getting its fiscal house in order, capital will flood into our coffers. The world is dying to see the U.S. do the right thing. Will we? I'm not hopeful. Just a brief note on the current economy. The figure on March housing starts was better than expected, though home builder confidence hit a new low. While March existing home sales were also better, though we are far from being out of the woods. You can build the case we've bottomed, however. Give me another month or two to see what happens to median home prices, which in the case of the existing category rose to $159,600 in March over February's revised $156,100. 40% of home sales are still of the distressed variety, and 25% of mortgages remain underwater. The positives in the earnings news of the week were contained in reports out of the likes of IBM and Intel, both of whose revenues were up over year-ago levels, and assigned business spending has indeed picked up. In a normal cycle, the consumer would then follow, though consumer markets remain soft, according to Intel CEO Paul Otellini. One disturbing item was the latest report on Philly area manufacturing, which dropped big time. Manufacturing has been leading the way in the recovery, and this was the first indicator to stumble some. Part of it could be Japan-related, but we need more data to tell if it's a new trend. But one thing is clear, thanks to the above debate on deficits and S&P's warning, the dollar tanked anew, and that benefited gold and silver in particular, with the former hitting a new nominal high above $1,500, while the latter at $46 is now close to the 1980 all-time high. If Congress ever got serious, the resulting dollar rally would kill the commodity bull run, or at least lead to a very sharp correction. But until that day, Even though I'm not in either trade, I can't help but think of the great Burl Ives and his song from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Silver and Gold, just by the pleasure it gives here on Earth. Yep, I have lots of friends who have been doing well with all things silver and gold. Turning to Europe, where I head this week only to get slaughtered by our damn piece of crap currency, the drumbeat on Greece having to restructure its debt is rising, with even the Germans seeming to almost welcome it despite the huge losses that would entail for the German banking system. Negotiations, I apologize. One thing to look out for, though, however, took place in Finland. Euro member Finland's parliamentary election has gigantic potential ramifications thanks to the rise of the anti-immigrant, anti-bailout True Finns party that saw its share of the vote rise from 4% in 2007 to 19% and a third-place finish. Negotiations will begin next week on whether to include the True Finns in a new government, though there is really no way you can exclude them. Understand the import here. All 17 euro nations must approve the coming bailout plan for Portugal, assuming their caretaker government can push through a program before their June snap election, and that is far from a given. So if the True Finns say they will only join the government if the government votes no to a bailout, you have instant chaos. Heck, it's just a freaking mess all around on the continent. Some say the euro economy will do just fine. I say no way because of the coming unrest in the streets that seems to me inevitable, including over the immigration issue. On the week, holiday-shortened week, the Dow Jones and S&P advanced 1.3% each, with the Dow finishing the week at 12,505, highest level since June 2008. NASDAQ, led by the likes of Apple's and Intel's earnings, rose 2%. But the markets ignored a new surge in oil prices to $112, and by Monday, gasoline will be nearing $4 a gallon on a nationwide basis. One other negative that was ignored was a second straight week of jobless claims back over the 400,000 level. By the way, regarding Apple and another spectacular earnings report, with sales jumping 83% to $24.7 billion. For the quarter, they sold 18.7 million iPhones, 4.69 million iPads, 3.76 million Macs, and 9.02 million iPods. There will be no podcast next Saturday. I'm traveling to Paris for a week. So next weekend, check out my Week in Review commentary at stocksandnews.com. Have a great week. Happy Easter.